many of our leading finest research organizations that arguably are producing the world's best biomedical research, they are facing budgetary shortfalls, the likes of which we have never seen. And I want to encourage them to use this crisis, because that's exactly what they're all in right now, to look at privacy-enhancing technologies.
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Today's world of AI is changing faster than expected. We see new models each claiming to dominate the competition. The competitive nature of AI calls for building massive infrastructure that requires major capital deployment. Within all the AI noise, there's a signal that needs to be heard in order to achieve the promised breakthroughs of precision medicine and AI. It does not involve building models or cleaning data, but instead addresses the most important aspect of healthcare AI development. Today, let's talk about the need for a secure collaboration platform that connects algorithm developers with data stewards. We're fortunate to have Mary Beth Chalk, co-founder of Beekeeper AI, a California-based company that is accelerating AI development and deployment with a secure collaboration platform for AI developers and data providers. Welcome, Mary Beth.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Me too. I want you to help educate our audience today on a number of topics. We'll cover the Beekeeper AI technology for sure, but I also want to discuss some of the key milestones you encountered establishing Beekeeper AI as a well-funded entity. You have a very compelling personal story. Let's start with that and also share the story behind the name Beekeeper AI.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story, Bob. Thank you so much. So I've had the experience of working inside of both the Mass General Brigham and then also the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center in the innovation area. And I've done two spinouts, one each at each of those institutions. And so I've had that opportunity to sit on the inside of academic medicine and then find a great idea that captured my heart and imagination, and then the experience of pulling that IP out of the academic center into a venture-backed company. And so what I did at the Center for Digital Health Innovation at UCSF was I headed up business development there, and we were focused on AI validation and deploying digital technologies at UCSF. And I was working with the other founders of Beekeeper AI at the time there, and we realized that there was a real barrier to enabling AI to compute on real-world data while also preserving individual privacy of that data and maintaining the data where it lived. So as we looked across at the fintech space and the government security sectors, they were using a new technology at the time, and this was now 6 or 7 years ago, called confidential computing. And of course, the whole field of privacy-enhancing technologies was just beginning to emerge at that time. And as we looked at that, we thought there was a direct correlation to the privacy protections and IP protections that we needed to be able to deliver within the healthcare space. So that began our journey. And the name Beekeeper AI came about as we began to contemplate, is there a natural analogy to what we're doing? And of course, beekeepers are responsible for the health of hives. And within hives, you have bees that have different roles for what they do. And of course, they're quite busy and industrious. And when they work together well and collaborate, they produce honey. And so as we looked at this analogy in nature, we said, we're beekeepers. We create a secure hive where data and intellectual property, AI models, for example, can come together securely and work together to produce honey. So that's where it came from.
That's an incredible story. I always ask people how the name gets started. IBM, International Business Machine, they want to displace another company, which was National Cash Register. And IBM said, we need to do better than a national cash register. We need to be an international business machine. And so there's always a story behind the names, but I love the metaphor that the beekeeper story brings to life. Now, on a personal basis, you feel like this is an important tool because it can really help do discovery of diseases and problems and things like that. You had a personal encounter. Do you want to share that with us as well?
Yes. So I am a breast cancer survivor. And 5 years ago, when I went in for my mammogram, I had a very tiny pinhead size spot on my mammogram that was lodged next to my chest wall. And normally when you're getting positioned on the machine, that's a very difficult place for the imaging technologist to position a woman. And it can be done wrong. So I got lucky that day, and luck shouldn't have anything to do with finding cancer early, but I got lucky because the technologist perfectly positioned me. And then I was lucky again when the image went to the radiologist, because normally the radiologist is reading mammograms. They save them up and they will batch review 80, 100 mammograms all at one time.
Wow.
And so it happened that I got, again, lucky that day that my radiologist was not overly tired, and that he actually stayed with the image and found that tiny little speck, circled it as suspicious, and began to instigate the process for biopsy and then everything that would follow. And as he came in, he said, we've got a suspicious finding here. He said, this is exactly why we do mammograms. I was sitting there as a healthcare person, have been in the field for 35 years, thinking, I just got lucky and I shouldn't have had to have been lucky. I wish that the AI had been in the positioning room with the tech and had flagged red, yellow, green on my positioning at each of my positions. I wish that image had gone into the queue for the radiologist with that spot already circled, so that if he or she were fatigued that particular day or distracted for some other reason, that my image was still served up as a priority review that needed a little extra time and attention.
Wow, you're addressing a very important topic. Now, you're trying to make a lot of people lucky instead of unlucky with some of this technology. We'll get more into that here in a few minutes when we start to talk about some of the technology issues. I'm always interested in, you alluded to how you had some partners that you're familiar with, and a lot of the startups today, they come out of a dorm, they're maybe in a garage, and most of them are very young, smart technologists, but you and your partners have many years, I want to say we're old, but many years of success in building companies and getting VC funding and with healthy exits as well. And so how important was your relationship here in getting the company up and going quickly?
The founders, each of us are, and I can safely say this on air, each of us are well over our mid-40s. Some of us much more older are mid-40s. And for us, this really is a mission, because if you think about the ability for these amazing algorithms, like detecting that dot on a mammogram image, or ensuring that a technician had a woman or a man positioned correctly on the machine, those cannot get deployed at the point of care until they've actually been tested and they've demonstrated consistent performance on real world, real clinical data.
Yeah.
And it's that privacy concern, it's that last mile of demonstrating performance at the point of care on real world data that is the cause of failure in AI. So we saw an opportunity to transform healthcare, but realized that unless we solved this one last mile problem, enabling AI to compute on real world data, the AI industry and healthcare was going to falter.
So you stood on the shoulders of giants by leveraging academia, intellectual property, trying to bring that out into the real world for commercialization. If you had to start from scratch, luckily you and your team had a long history at UCSF where you had the opportunity to understand what was available. getting that transferred technology out of a university, is that a long and difficult negotiation?
So again, the benefit of the founders, we had four co-founders. We have four co-founders. This was my second time to extract IP developed within an academic medical center. And the patterns were actually quite similar. My first startup, as I mentioned, was a spin out from Mass General Brigham. And then Beekeeper AI, of course, was spun out of UCSF. And one of the key challenges that you face as you begin to transition from academic medicine into the commercial world is the misalignment between incentives and expectations. Academia runs off of different expectations and different timelines than venture capitalists. And so venture capitalists expect different returns, different timelines for results. And so it's at that birthing moment where you have great science that needs to get pulled or pushed rather out into the real world with great capital and great funding. The stress becomes, how do you negotiate a transaction or a deal between two parties that are from the very get-go misaligned? And that's not negative. It's not a negative. It's just, it's how they work. They just work for different reasons. Yeah. And so it requires a knowledge of the two worlds, a knowledge of how the two worlds think. You can't change the two worlds. It's literally just time and patience. And also, I hate to say, a little bit of luck to get there, because you can have time and patience and still not get a transaction done when you've got two parties that are really profoundly different.
Yeah, hopefully you make the pie just a little bit bigger for both parties, for all parties, that it takes a while for people to see that and understand that what you are doing with the technology, they would never be able to do.
Yes,
they would never be able
right.
to fund it, never be able to accomplish the milestones that you've done.
Yes.
So I think, thanks for sharing that. A lot of people are curious about that. A lot of people don't know. They have lots of relationships, but they don't have a clue on who to find help to make these things happen like that. But you guys have figured that out. Before we get into the technology of Escrow AI, that's your award-winning product.
It is.
I want to cover a couple technical terms just to make sure that people understand what we're dealing with here. We hear a lot about algorithm developers and data stewards. And I think we know what the algorithm developers are. I'm an algorithm developer, sort of. I'm on the very shallow end of the pool, but we try to design and train AI or do machine learning. And the data stewards, those are the big hospitals, the research institutions. What is their symbiotic relationship? They have different needs too, right?
They do. And data stewards can also be algorithm developers. So it can be both and. But for the purposes of this conversation, the data stewards, and in Europe, the phrase either a data controller or a data processor. So a data controller could be, and this all falls under the umbrella of data steward, but the data controller is legally and from a regulatory perspective responsible for maintaining the sovereignty and the privacy of their data. If they, through a business associates agreement in the US, determine that they need someone to help them process that data, then those protection rights through the BAA are extended over to a data processor. So when we use the umbrella term data steward, we include both the data controller and the data processor.
Okay.
And oftentimes in academic institutions, the academic medical centers are both controllers and processors. They're staffed for that. Typically, the large health centers or health systems are also both roles. They will have data analysts who are there to curate data sets for AI and ML work, and they will be both data controller and processor. But occasionally, you'll get to a mid-size health system that has incredibly valuable data, and they may have the control of their data, but they don't have the staff or the resourcing to do the processing, and they may have outsourced that to a third party.
Okay. I took a short course at MIT. It was an online course, so I wasn't up in Massachusetts, but it was a 7-week course. And one of the things I got out of that course, it was AI for healthcare. But the first big point was, What problem are you trying to solve? So let's talk about Escrow AI. I want you to explain in real simple terms what problems that it solves and how it's deployed, especially in a healthcare perspective.
Yep, perfect. So typically when, let's say, Bob, you have an AI model that solves a particular problem. Oh, let's go back to the breast imaging example.
Okay.
Let's say you have an AI model that detects early stage breast cancer, and you have trained it and tested it elsewhere, and you're convinced it's the best thing ever. And but you take it to a large academic medical center that's known, like a National Cancer Institute, an NCI institute, and you say, trust me, it's good. I've tested it at all of these other locations. And that cancer center is going to say, well, but how do I know it really works on my population? Because I have a heavy concentration of Asian women. They're known for dense breast tissue. Have you really demonstrated that this is going to work on dense breast tissue, for example?
Yeah, I hope I have, but I may not know.
So you may not know. So here's a case where they say, I'm not willing to license your algorithm until I know it's going to be effective on my data. And you're going to say, if I send my algorithm to you, you're going to be able to read my weights. And that means my intellectual property is going to be exposed. Then on the data side, you're going to say, I want you to deploy my algorithm into your radiology reading process workflow. And because I want to test it. And they're going to say, get in line. Our IT staffs are backed up. The integration is a nightmare. It's going to take forever. And we don't know what's in your code base that might be able to read our patient data. And you might be doing something nefarious unintentionally within our data environment. So what you begin to have is this massive standoff between an innovator and someone who holds the data.
Yes.
So what we do is we're actually the secure pipes in between those two parties, which is why our platform's called Escrow AI. So you as the algorithm developer get to escrow your intellectual property in ways technically that I'll describe a little bit later, but you containerize it and then we transport it. And just think about Star Trek. We transport it to where that data lives, and then we protect that data while we bring the data and the algorithm together into a secure vault-like environment called a trusted execution environment. And within that vault, they can securely compute against one another. And then if it's validation, a report comes out back to the developer about sensitivity, specificity. If the algorithm is training, obviously the trained algorithm comes back out. So it escrows the data, it escrows the IP, but it enables the two to compute securely without one seeing the other.
So I understand you're continuing to invest in technology, but does Escrow AI, does it require a team to deploy it, or is it something that works all on its own? How complicated is it to manage this very important infrastructure, the data and the algorithms? Is it plug and play? Yeah. I don't think so, is it?
Well, it actually is. So the beauty of what we've built, it's actually an application layer. And you talked about earlier in the podcast that we were building on the shoulders of giants. We did. We built on the shoulder of Intel and their work with TDX and confidential computing. We built on the shoulders of Microsoft Azure and their commitment to confidential computing. And so what we've been able to do is take these technical solutions, these point solutions, and then understanding the healthcare workflow, design an application that just integrated and automated the use of these amazing point solutions into a workflow that the typical AI developer and data steward understand. So that application, that software application, integrates and automates this amazing security technology. And in fact, 3 days ago, I was on a call with a customer who had just activated their Escrow AI license, meaning their trusted execution environment. And I said, curious, how long did it take you? And he said, I had blocked 7 hours to do the work. He said, I was done in 3.5 hours.
Wow.
That's it, Bob. And then we maintain it because it's software. So it's an initial configuration set up in your Azure tenant. You configure it. We will be launching in AWS this next year, and then also with a hybrid on-prem solution, which will be a little more difficult to maintain because obviously the computing will happen in the data center. But right now, the cloud-based, it's ours, and then it's just there to run.
It sounds like this is going to be an enabling technology that will allow some of this precision medicine to be developed a lot faster. It's Right. going to eliminate some of these slow down roadblocks that are important roadblocks. Like you said, parties with different interests, they're going to have a standoff here. But if people can understand the power of this type of collaboration, work as a bee in a beehive, then I think we can see things like we're expecting to see them, not just the models changing, not just the faster computers, but also the implementation processes that are necessary to make things happen. So, Mary Beth, did you have to get FDA approval at all for what you're doing?
No, because it's enabling infrastructure. We're AI agnostic, so we're not developing the AI that's used just at the point of care. We're data agnostic, so we can compute on all kinds of data, including surgical video data. Any type of data can compute. Where we do enforce compliance is with security certifications like SOC 2. So we're SOC 2 compliant, and that typically checks a very large box for chief security officers. And when they hear that we're SOC 2 certified, they exhale and go, oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, those are all very important check boxes there. Mm-hmm. Every podcast, I'm so fortunate because I get to learn more. And one more little educational session here with you, Mary Beth. There's a term I hear you referred to. It's called zero trust. And quite honestly, that's confusing to me. I like trust, zero trust. And I'm sure our audience would like to learn more about it. What does it mean, zero trust, and how's it used?
Yeah, so it's a term that was developed at the federal level. And it sounds a bit like an oxymoron, but essentially what it means is that you are creating within your organization a system of processes, procedures, and technologies that eliminate the need for you to rely either on human-to-human trust or contractually based trust. And so you're enabling through process, procedure, and technology. You're enabling all of that to ensure that zero trust has to be extended through contracts and human beings. And essentially what you're doing is you're automating full regulatory compliance, and you're making it 100% leak-proof, shock-proof, or if shocks happen to the system, then they're quickly and shortly contained and addressed.
Not everybody's been down the path you've been down with venture capital, et cetera. So I think a benefit to our audience, I understand that you have quite a portfolio of patents. So when is enough, and why is it important in your business plan?
That's a great question. And it becomes important initially. So you go through phases as a company. When you're spinning out, it becomes great validation that your idea is novel and that you're on the leading edge of what you're doing. As you begin to achieve traction in the marketplace and as you begin to onboard customers, you want to continue to build out the moat of protection so that you've got time to be able to mature your software and your platform while you are working in these very advanced, novel, leading edge solutions. And so that becomes important from that standpoint, but ultimately that patent portfolio becomes very attractive at a time of exit because a larger entity may look at that patent portfolio and it become the enabling infrastructure that's necessary for their next big growth spurt, and they can go into it with great confidence that it will be a very unique competitive differentiator.
So it really enhances the value
Yes.
definition of your organization. Very good. Well,
Mm-hmm.
Mary Beth, any last comments from you? I remember Sir Conrad Hilton, when TV first came out, they gave him like 3 minutes on TV and said, "What do you want to say?" And he said, "If you stay at one of my fine hotels, would you please put the shower curtain inside the tub? It cost us millions of dollars." Okay. So here's your audience. What would you like to tell your audience here? What's your final summary here?
So, for those of you in regulated data industries and specifically in healthcare right now, we have just experienced a shockwave with the NIH policy decision to cap the indirect research rates to 15%. So, for many of our leading, finest research organizations that arguably are producing the world's best biomedical research, they are facing budgetary shortfalls, the likes of which we have never seen. And I want to encourage them to use this crisis, because that's exactly what they're all in right now. Use this crisis to look at privacy-enhancing technologies to streamline their research, enable research on real-world data, stop doing the activities that are non-value added, like de-identification, which is an old method for privacy preserving, and look at what these new modern technologies can enable them to do. So while we may be in crisis on the healthcare research side, I also think it provides a wonderful opportunity to re-examine how and why you are doing certain things.
Wow, that's a great message there. Thank you. I want to have a few bragging rights for Beekeeper AI, because you guys have recently been recognized with a couple prestigious awards. So 2024, the AI and Data Product Award winner. Wow, that is the top in the data products across a lot of sectors. And another one that you got recognized for was the most innovative healthcare AI platform for 2024. Man, where do you go from there? You've got to keep winning and get some more trophies on the wall here.
Exactly. Bob, thanks for bringing that up. We're quite proud of those accomplishments.
Oh, you should be. Mary Beth, thank you for your leadership and insights. Our audience, they'll be looking forward to you in the future. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's GOPI, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.